Sri Chaitanya Lila, Adikanda, Chapter 1. In India, in Navadvip, over 500 years ago, there lived a very pious Vaishnav Brahmin named Advaita. He and his wife Sita lived simply in a modest dwelling, as if helping one another to advance in spiritual life. Advaita was highly learned and possessed all the qualities of a Brahmin in full measure. Indeed, Advaita possessed many uncommon qualities, for he was none other than an incarnation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Mahavishnu, the source of all the manifested universes. All things considered, Advaita was a very observant fellow. Daily he would discourse with the various Vaishnav pandits of Navadvipa on the nature of the Absolute Truth. At these meetings, and on his way to and from them as well, he would notice how the people in general had become corrupt and devoid of devotion to God. The smarter Brahmins performed acts of piety only to reap the benefits of such activity. Philosophers spawned theory after theory in an endless cycle of exposition and refutation, not to discover the Absolute Truth, but simply to feed their bellies and win some fame as men of letters. Saddest of all, the common man, whose simple mind, unclouded by the dust storms of empiric logic, had formerly allowed him to execute his religious duty in a spirit of closeness and devotion to God, now simply looked no further than the immediate satisfaction of the senses. These things made Advaita sad, because he knew very well the ultimate goal of life. Advaita could understand that all these people were suffering miserably. Because of their pious and impious activities, they would be repeatedly forced to take birth in hellish conditions of life, unless they somehow developed their dormant love of God. Because of his great compassion for the fallen souls, Advaita began to seek a solution to their predicament. Advaita thought, "In the fallen age of Kali, there is no religion other than the chanting of the holy name of the Lord. If Sri Krishna himself were to appear as an incarnation, he could teach the path of religion and devotion to God by his personal example. Only then can the people of the world be saved. But how can he be persuaded to come?" After much thought, Advaita began to consider that if he humbly petitioned the Lord through prayer, he might induce Krishna to inaugurate the movement of the chanting of the holy name. While thinking like this, a very sweet verse came to his mind. "Sri Krishna, who is very affectionate toward his devotees, sells himself to a devotee who merely offers a tulsi leaf and a palm full of water." Advaita thought, "Not finding any way to repay the debt he owes to one who offers him a tulsi leaf and water, Lord Krishna thinks, there is no wealth in my possession that is equal to a tulsi leaf and water. Thus, the Lord liquidates the debt by offering his own self to the devotee." Happy and satisfied that he had at last discovered the means to bring about the descent of the Lord, Advaita sat down on the bank of the Ganges and worshipped Shalagram Shila with tulsi manjaris and Ganges water, while meditating in great ecstasy on the lotus feet of the Lord and loudly petitioning him to appear. He quoted a prayer by Lord Brahma, saying, "O my Lord, you always dwell in the vision and hearing of your pure devotees. You also live in their lotus-like hearts, which are purified by devotional service. O my Lord, who are glorified by exalted prayers, you show special favor to your devotees by manifesting yourself in the eternal forms in which they worship you." The cries of Advaita were so loud that they penetrated the eight coverings of the universe and in no time reached the ears of the Lord in Vaikuntha. Hearing the compassionate plea of his devotee, Advaita, who is an expansion of himself, Lord Krishna agreed to incarnate for the welfare of all and distribute love of God amongst the masses of fallen souls. Meanwhile, Jagannath Mishra and Sachi Devi, who were Nanda and Jashoda and Krishna Lila, also began to worship the lotus feet of Lord Vishnu. Previously, they had had eight daughters in succession, all of whom had died just shortly after birth. Now they desired a son, and they devoutly prayed to the Lord to fulfill their desire. Soon, Sachi conceived and gave birth to Vishwarup, who was an expansion of Baladev. He was a reservoir of transcendental qualities, and he gave Jagannath Mishra and Sachi Devi great pleasure. Being very pleased that the Lord had kindly given them such a wonderful son, they specifically began to serve the lotus feet of Govinda in the spirit of thanksgiving. Shortly thereafter, in the year 1406 of the Shakabda era, 1485 AD, Lord Krishna entered the bodies of Jagannath Mishra and Sachi Devi. Many marvelous signs occurred at this time, indicating that Krishna was about to appear. Jagannath Mishra told Sachi, "I see wonderful things. Your body is effulgent, as though the goddess of fortune were now staying personally in my home. Anywhere and everywhere I go, all people offer me respect. Even without my asking, they voluntarily give me riches, clothing, and paddy." Sri Anantadev, with his unlimited mouth, triumphantly sang of the blessed event. This melodious sound was heard by Jagannath Mishra and Sachi, as if in a dream. Mother Sachi saw the demigods in heaven offering her prayers because of the Lord's presence within her womb, and Jagannath Mishra had a vision of the effulgent abode of the Lord entering within his heart, and then, from his heart, enter into the heart of Sachi Devi. Understanding that a great personality was about to take birth, both husband and wife became very jubilant. After 13 months of pregnancy, however, Jagannath Mishra became greatly apprehensive. He approached Sachi's father, Nilambar Chakravarti, who was an accomplished astrologer. Nilambar assuaged his son-in-law by telling him that the child was simply waiting for the planets to assume an auspicious position, and that he would take birth during that very month. That month was Falgun, in the year 1407 of Shakabda era, 1486 AD, and the auspicious moment arrived upon the eve of a lunar eclipse. During such celestial phenomena, it was customary for the followers of Vedic culture to stand on the waters of a sacred river and loudly chant the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. Thus, the Lord appropriately made his appearance in the midst of the congregational chanting of his holy name. At that time, the atmosphere in 10 directions became jubilant, and all the constellations assumed their most auspicious positions just to greet the Lord. All beings in the three worlds, moving and non-moving, were overwhelmed with transcendental bliss, and the curious demigods danced and sang to sweet music performed on celestial instruments. Just as the full moon was rising, the shadow planet Rahu, considering that there was no need of a luminary covered with black marks in the presence of the spotless moon of Sri Gaurasundar, covered the face of the moon, who was actually hiding his face in shame. As the resounding of the holy name reached its climax, Sri Krishna Chaitanya made his divine appearance at the Yoga Peet, the house of Sachi. Strange forms crowded into the courtyard. Some lay prostrate on the bare earth, offering obeisances, while others waved chamaras. Another held an umbrella over the Lord's head, and the rest sang, danced, and beat on drums in boundless joy. At that same instant, in his house in Shantipur, Advaita jumped up in delight. Joining arm in arm with Haridas Thakur, he began to dance ecstatically to the surprise of all onlookers. The ocean of ecstasy which flooded Nadia at that time is impossible to describe. Immediately after taking birth, the Lord began to smile. Seeing his beautiful smiling face, Sachi and Jagannath Mishra experienced the epitome of joy, while Sachi's lady attendants became perplexed at his unprecedented beauty and character. Sita Devi appreciated the fact that, but for a different color, the newborn child directly resembled the son of Maharaj Nanda. Narottam Thakur confirms, "Rajendra Nandanaye Sachi Sula Hailo Se." The son of Sachi is none other than the son of Nanda and Jashoda. Huge crowds appeared at the house of Jagannath Mishra, desiring darshan of the divine child. Many of these personalities were unknown to Jagannath Mishra because they were actually gods and goddesses, assuming the forms of brahmanas and brahmanis. Disguised as wives of brahmanas, all the celestial ladies, including the wives of Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, the Shringa, and Vishishta Rishi, came there to offer gifts. These unknown matrons would bless the child by saying, may you live forever. Then they would humbly take the dust from Mother Sati's feet, much to her surprise. No one could understand who was coming and who was going, who was dancing and who was singing, nor could they understand each other's language. But in effect, all unhappiness and lamentation was immediately dissipated, and people became all jubilant. Thus, Jagannath Mishra was also overwhelmed with joy. Sri Chandrasekhar and Srivas Pandit performed the purificatory birth rites, while Purandara Mishra gave gifts to all those who brought presents. Sita Thakurani, consort of Advaita, and Malini Devi, consort of Srivas, came together to offer presents and feast their eyes on the beautiful moon-like face of the divine child. Sri Nilambar Chakravarti, taking Jagannath Mishra aside, whispered to him that the signs on the child's body indicate a great transcendental personality who could deliver the whole world. Therefore, he was named Vishwambar, meaning he who nourishes and maintains the three worlds by distributing love of God. Sita Devi also named him Nimai, because he was born under a neem tree. Sita Devi hoped that this name, being antiseptic like the neem tree, would counteract ghosts, witches, and evil spirits who might be attracted by his uncommon beauty. After considering the auspicious position of the stars, planets, and constellations at the time of his birth, Nilambar Chakravarti concluded that the boy would be far greater than any king, and greater in learning than even Brihaspati, the priest of the heavenly gods. Another Brahmin, whose identity and origin were not fully known, also gave his opinion. His astrological analysis was similar to that of Nilambar Chakravarti, but he added an even more astounding conclusion to his predictions. This boy is none other than the Supreme Lord Narayan himself. He will reestablish the principles of religion. Fellow jivas, and everyone will love him who is himself the embodiment of love for Krishna. Even the yavanas, the declared enemies of Vishnu, will worship his lotus feet, and all the world will sing his glories. There is only one event that the brahmana did not mention to Jagannath Mishra. He could not bear to disclose at this time the Lord's future leela of accepting the sannyas order of life. Jagannath Mishra was so moved by the words of the Brahmin that he wanted to give him everything he had in charity, but unfortunately he had very, very little. Being unable to properly repay him for his joyous predictions, Jagannath Mishra simply grabbed his feet and burst into tears, unable to contain his joy any longer. The Brahmin also clasped the feet of Jagannath Mishra and shed tears, shouting the names of Hari and Krishna. The birth, activities, and pastimes of Sri Chaitanya are all equal to those of Sri Krishna. His birth is a completely transcendental pastime. Similarly, his parents and family members are all transcendental, liberated souls from Goloka. Their desire for a child is not a material desire, otherwise Krishna himself would not have appeared as their son. Their desire was to render direct service to Godhead in the mood of Vatsalya Rasa. The intensity of their love of Sri Krishna Chaitanya was so great that it kept them perfectly under the spell of Yoga Maya. By not understanding their child's identity as God, they remained absorbed in pure parental love for him. Krishna keeps his supreme position covered to prevent divine awe and reverence in his parents, a mood which would impede their spontaneous loving impulse to serve him as a son. Krishna prefers a subordinate role to such pure, loving devotees, as if dependent on them for his safety and life. In this way, they can serve him eternally to their heart's content. Chapter 4. In Navadvip, it was customary for children to begin their education at the age of 8. At this time, the entire family joined together to perform the Vidyaramba ceremony, one of the 10 purificatory ceremonies mentioned in the Vedas as compulsory for a Brahmin. At this ceremony, the child is taught to read his first letters, marking the beginning of his education. When the time came to perform this ceremony for Nimai, the entire household of Jagannath Misha was filled with excitement. To everyone's amazement, when the alphabet was brought before Nimai, he immediately read all the letters at first sight, without ever having been taught. When he actually began to read and write, his only subjects were the Lord's holy names, such as Krishna, Ram, Murari, Mukunda, and Banamali. At this age, the Lord's juvenile pastimes became manifest, corresponding to those of child Krishna as Gopal. Frequently, Nimai would make impossible demands, and then, when his wishes were not fulfilled, he would cry loudly and roll in the dust, dashing his hands and legs against the ground. Sometimes he would desire a bird that flew across the sky, or would demand the moon and the stars. "I must have it," he would shout, and he would be solaced only when someone would chant the holy names of Krishna. Thus everyone in the house of Jagannath Misha always chanted the holy names of Krishna to pacify little Nimai in his fits of anger. Because of this, the house of Jagannath Misha was non-different from the spiritual world. On one Ekadasi day, however, Nimai's violent crying could not be quieted even by kirtan. Asked about the cause of his grief, Nimai replied that he was very ill and therefore lacked the strength to move or to be quiet. When he was offered anything he wished, Nimai replied, "If you actually want to save my life, then you must go at once to the house of the two Brahmins, Jagadish Pandit and Hiranya Pandit. Tell them to bring all the offerings which they have cooked for Vishnu and give them to me. Only by eating those offerings will I be cured of my ailment." Mother Sachi was shocked to hear this, thinking it improper to eat offerings which were meant for Vishnu, especially on Ekadasi day. But everyone else burst into laughter and assured Nimai that they would immediately get the offerings for him. Jagannath Misha quickly proceeded to the house of those two Brahmins, who were struck with wonder upon hearing Nimai's request. "This little boy is most wonderful," they thought. "How does he know that the day is Ekadasi? And how does he know that we've prepared a great variety of offerings for Vishnu today? It appears that Sri Gopal himself must be dwelling in the figure of this little boy and is speaking through this child." Thinking in this way, the two Brahmins were filled with ecstasy and they immediately took all their offerings to the house of Jagannath Misha. With great pleasure, they gave him all the foodstuffs, understanding that in this way, the offerings were actually being offered to Krishna himself. The Lord was very much pleased and ate with great relish. When he had finished, Nimai began to bombard everyone with his remnants while he himself danced and chanted the name of Krishna in the middle of the assembly. It is the custom of a strict Vaishnav to fast on the Ekadasi day, but this does not apply to the Lord himself, who, of course, always eats sumptuously, no matter what the occasion. Jagadish and Hiranya Pandits offered their food to Nimai with firm faith that the boy was none other than the Supreme Lord, Sri Krishna, for whom the offerings had been prepared. Such faith in the Lord is only possible for one who has obtained His special mercy and can never be present in the heart of one who is materially contaminated. The Lord cannot be seen by the qualification of the living entity himself, but He can be seen by a devotee who humbly seeks enlightenment from the Lord. Krishna's supreme blessing comes in the form of devotion to Him and is thus manifest in the heart of a Vaishnava. This cannot be understood by conditioned living entities, but only by devotees. Little Vishwambar continued to be exceedingly restless throughout his childhood. Indeed, he became the leader of all the turbulent Brahmin boys of the neighborhood. He and his friends were constantly engaged in some kind of mischief and regularly raided different places of Navadvip. No one could check his trepidity. He would joke with other children, provoking them until the affair developed into a brawl. When such a fight would occur, the party of the Lord would invariably emerge victorious due to the superior strength of the Lord, and the opposing party would be forced to retreat. At midday, Nimai would finish his studies and go to bathe in the Ganges in the company of his childhood friends. In the water, he and his friends would engage in frivolous sports by splashing water at one another. In those days, Navadvipa was a most opulent city, and huge crowds would gather at the bathing ghats. Among the crowds were respectable and grave householders, revered sannyasis, and large numbers of mendicants. Sporting with his friends, the Lord's turbulence, as well as his extraordinary beauty, would attract the attention of everyone. Nimai would mischievously splash water by kicking it with his lotus feet, drenching everyone in the area with a shower of mercy. Thinking themselves contaminated, the people would bathe over and over again. Sometimes Nimai would come before a Brahmin sitting on the riverbank in deep meditation and spew a big mouthful of water right in his face. "Just open your eyes, O Brahmin," Nimai would say. "The object of your meditation is standing right in front of you. The Supreme Lord Narayan has descended in the Kali Yuga, right here in Navadvip." The Brahmin, opening his eyes and seeing Nimai standing there, would protest, "Nimai, get out of here." Nimai would then run away from that place to another place where a Brahmin was worshipping Lord Shiva. Stealing the Brahmin's Shiva Linga, Nimai would continue running and steal yet another Brahmin's chadar. Running in this way, Nimai would at last reach the place where one Brahmin was preparing to worship Lord Vishnu. When the Brahmin had gone to bathe in preparation for his worship, Nimai would sit on the seat prepared for Lord Vishnu and eat all the offerings meant for Lord Vishnu. Putting on the garlands, he would then decorate himself with all the flowers meant for Lord Vishnu. Returning from his bath, the Brahmin would see that Nimai had taken the whole offering meant for Lord Vishnu and would become perfectly furious. Upon seeing the Brahmin's anger, Nimai would simply laugh and say to him, "Why are you lamenting? He for whom the offering was meant has just eaten it. You should be very pleased." Sometimes Nimai would take all the women's clothes and put them on the men's side, whose clothes he would then place on the women's side. He would throw sand on the Brahmins when they had just finished taking their baths, and sometimes he would take the seat of another Brahmin and himself engage in the worship of Lord Vishnu. By this time he would have huge crowds of Brahmins and others chasing him to chastise him, and although he would try to hide from them, he would be unable to do so. Just as it is impossible to hide the full moon in the sky, similarly, because of his uncommon beauty and effulgence, Nimai could not hide, even in the midst of thousands of people. Being unable to hide, Nimai would dive into the Ganges as a last resort. Swiftly swimming underwater like a minnow, no one could detect his movements. "Where is Nimai now?" the people would wonder. "Where will he appear next?" As they were pondering this, Nimai would swim exactly in front of a Brahmin chanting his Gayatri, grab his legs, and pull him under the water. Sometimes Nimai would go to the place where the young girls would worship various demigods in order to get nice husbands. He would steal all their clothes and then verbally abuse them. Sometimes he would forcibly confiscate all the flowers for the puja and scatter them in all directions. Sometimes he would throw sand on the girls' bodies when they had just finished bathing, or scare them by sneaking up behind them and shouting into their ears. On some occasions he would spew water into their faces, or throw prickly ochre seeds into their hair, while threatening to marry some others. He would do these things regularly, and as boldly as if he were the son of a king. Sometimes the Lord would come after the girls had taken their baths and were already engaged in worshipping the different demigods. Nimai would sit down among them and address them, "Worship me, and I shall give you good husbands or good benedictions. The Ganges and Goddess Durga are my maidservants. Not to speak of other demigods, even Lord Shiva is my servant." Without anyone's permission, the Lord would smear the sandalwood pulp all over his own body, put the flower garlands around his own neck, and snatch and eat all the offerings of sweetmeats, bananas, and rice. Once, the girls appeared to become very angry at the Lord for this behavior. "Dear Nimai," they told him, "you are just like our brother in our village relationship. Therefore, it does not behoove you to act like this. Don't take our paraphernalia for worship of the demigods. Don't create a disturbance in this way." The Lord replied, "My dear sisters, I give you the benediction that your husbands will be very handsome, They will be learned, clever, and young, and possess abundant wealth and grains. Not only that, but you will each have 7 sons who will live long lives and be highly intelligent." Upon hearing this benediction of Nimai, the girls were inwardly very happy, but externally, as is natural for girls, they rebuked the Lord under the pretense of anger. When some of them fled, the Lord called after them angrily and advised them, "If you are miserly and do not give me the offerings, then every one of you will have an old husband with at least 4 co-wives." Hearing this supposed curse by Nimai, the girls, considering that he might have some uncommon knowledge or be empowered by demigods, became afraid that his curse might be effective. The girls then brought the offerings before the Lord, who ate them and blessed the girls to their satisfaction. One day, the Brahmins, being unable to stop Nimai by any means, went to the house of Jagannath Mishra and began complaining to him as follows. "Nimai has made a complete comedy scene of the bathing ghats on the sacred Ganges, and we are no longer able to take our baths there." Jagannath Mishra, upon hearing this, became very angry and said to the Brahmins, "I will go and punish him in such a way that he will never again dare to do such a thing." But because the Brahmins were not actually displeased, but considered themselves to be most fortunate, they immediately replied, "No, no, please don't punish him. Actually, your son is very wonderful." Being exceedingly pleased at heart at being the objects of so much of the Lord's mercy, the Brahmins were not actually thinking to complain against him. Rather, due to their ecstatic absorption in loving feelings for him, they were unable to stop talking about him. Still, Jagannath Mishra, in his devotional relationship of parental affection, considered it his duty to chastise his son, and he therefore proceeded to the bank of the Ganges in apparent anger. "Jagannath Mishra is coming," the girls told Nimai. "You'd better run immediately." Of course, being omniscient, Nimai already understood this, and he instructed his friends, "Tell Mishra that I did not come to the Ganges to bathe today, but went home from school by another road." Saying this, Nimai just disappeared. Just then, Jagannath Mishra appeared on the scene. Not seeing Nimai, he asked the children, "Where is Nimai?" "Nimai?" they replied. "He has not come today. Can you send him? It's no fun here without Nimai. He must have gone home from school by another road. We are still waiting for him." But some of the Brahmins came forward and said to Jagannath Mishra, "Vishwambar was here, but he ran home out of fear. But please, don't punish him. Whatever we said was in fun. No one in the 3 worlds is as fortunate as you are. Hunger, thirst, and sorrow can never affect you. You are truly serving the lotus feet of the Lord." "My son is the son of all of you," Jagannath Mishra replied. "Please don't take offense at his activities." Mishra then embraced all the Brahmins and returned home. Meanwhile, the girls had gone to the house of Mother Sachi to report Nimai's outrageous behavior. "Nimai is acting just as if he were the son of Nanda Maharaj," the girls said. "And if he is not checked, we will simply have to tell our own parents, and then there will be serious trouble." Hearing these things, Mother Sachi smiled and took the girls upon her lap. Speaking kindly to satisfy them, she told them, "When Nimai comes home, I will tie him up and punish him so that he will no longer cause any trouble for you." The girls then took the dust of Sachi's feet upon their heads and went back to the bathing ghat on the bank of the Ganges. Nimai came home carrying his books and appearing exactly as though he had just returned from school. His body and hair were perfectly dry, and ink spots decorated his body. He appeared just like a champak flower, surrounded on all sides by humming bees. "I'm going to bathe in the Ganges now," he shouted to Mother Sachi. "Please rub oil on my body." Hearing the voice of Nimai, Sachi's heart became filled with happiness. She gave him oil and wondered, how is it that the girls and the Brahmins complained that he was just bothering them at the bathing ghat, yet I see that he has just returned home from school. At that very moment, Jagannath Misa returned from the ghat. Nimai ran out and jumped into his arms. Being embraced by his child, Jagannath Misa was filled with great happiness, and he forgot all his anger. Then he saw that Nimai's body was still dusty and showed no sign of bathing. Thus he inquired from Nimai if he had bathed. "No, I haven't bathed today," Nimai said. "My friends are misbehaving at the ghat, and they are blaming me for everything." Having said this, and laughing in delight, Nimai ran back to the ghat. Joining his friends once again, Nimai informed them of his having fooled Jagannath Misa. They burst into uproarious laughter and embraced Nimai. Being praised and congratulated by his friends, Nimai then resumed his pastimes once again. Meanwhile, Jagannath Misa and Mother Sachi were still highly perplexed, trying to understand why the Brahmins were complaining about Nimai. The young girls might make up such stories, they thought, but Brahmins don't lie. Yet just after they told us of his pranks at the Ganges, Nimai returned from school with his books and his school dress, his body still dusty and his hair still dry. How can this be? How is our son performing pastimes simultaneously in two different places? Is Nimai some transcendental personality? Jagannath Misa and Mother Sachi then became very reverential and began to consider, is he some demigod? Or is it, could it be? Has the Supreme Lord of all creation taken birth in our family? Sri Krishna, as Nimai pondered, did not relish such a reverential mood in his devotees, for such feelings interrupted the flow of pure, spontaneous parental affection. Therefore, Nimai again appeared before them, whereupon they immediately forgot their feelings of awe and reverence. Seeing their divine son, they became completely reabsorbed in loving affection for him. Such is the great power of unadulterated transcendental love. This love covers the devotees so that they accept the Lord as their friend, child, or lover. In such a relationship, the Lord's unrivaled supremacy is in no way diminished. Rather, it is enhanced. Nor were the Brahmins and girls actually offended by his frivolous and turbulent behavior. A naughty boy is liked even more if his naughtiness is purely juvenile and innocent, as a result of an overabundance of childish energy. The Brahmins and girls complained to Jagannath Misa and Mother Sachi not because of any bad feelings, but because they simply couldn't stop talking about him. They were seeking any possible opportunity to glorify him more. In this way, the Supreme Lord enjoys intimate loving pastimes with his eternal friends, parents, and lovers. As the extremely restless and naughty child of Jagannath Misa and Mother Sachi, the Lord is no less the supreme controller of all of spiritual and material creations. Rather, in this role as the most wonderful and lovable Brahmin boy of Navadvip, the Lord, although covered by whimsical childhood emotions, is even more fully divine. Triumphs of learning. Playing the role of a secular scholar, the Lord amazed everyone with his enthusiasm for learning and teaching. Day and night, he would eagerly devour the Vedic literatures. After thoroughly digesting their import, he would deliver his verdict to his students, all of whom would sit very still, drinking in his every word, which was like nectar to the ears. Anyone who was fortunate enough to witness these scholarly pastimes of the Lord was suffused with great happiness and regarded in subsequent years as a blessed personality, the very sight of whom could free one from the bondage of the material world. By attentively hearing and chanting these academic pastimes of Nimai Pandit, we too can obtain the same benediction as those fortunate residents of Nadia. Professor Nimai had no shortage of students. Every day, 10 to 20 new Brahmin boys prostrated themselves at the feet of the Lord, seeking his tutelage. "We humbly beg your mercy," they would pray, "that we may have the good fortune of being enlightened by you. Even if we were to learn only a small fraction of what you teach us, we would be accounted great scholars nonetheless." The Lord laughed at their words and observed that what they said was most excellent. In this way, the Lord's pupils increased in number every day, and he formed innumerable groups that pursued their studies in many different parts of town. In the evening, Sri Gaurasundar would lead his pupils to the bank of the Ganges and sit in the midst of them, discoursing on the Shastras. Sri Vrindavandas Thakur has searched all the revealed scriptures to find an appropriate analogy for these charming episodes. After due consideration of their qualities, he rejected the following. 1. The comparison of the Lord and his disciples to the effulgent moon encircled by the stars of heaven is insufficient on the grounds that the moon has pockmarks and is subject to the process of waxing and waning, whereas the spotless subject of comparison, namely Sri Gaurasundar, is not only eternally full, but ever increasing. 2. Brihaspati, the preceptor of the heavenly planets, in the midst of his disciples, does not furnish a proper analogy because of his partiality to the demigods, whereas our Lord is the best friend of all living entities and especially shows his mercy to the most fallen. 3. Cupid, the demigod of love, in the company of his ratis, also fails to fulfill requirements for proper analogy, for the mind in which he makes his appearance becomes distracted and agitated, whereas the appearance of the Lord in one's mind dispels all other attachments and creates a state of purity and serenity. Similarly, all other analogies were found to be seriously defective, with one exception only. Sri Vrindavandas recalled the pastimes of the son of Nanda Maharaj, surrounded by the cowherd boys on the banks of the Jamuna. That self-same Krishna Chandra, it appeared, in the company of those very same cowherds, had now returned to earth in the form of a Brahmin and had gone to the banks of the Ganges to reenact his pastimes. Sri Vrindavandas Thakur laments his misfortune at having been born too late to personally witness these early pastimes of the Lord and cherishes the hope of taking birth wherever and whenever Sri Chaitanya and Nityananda manifest their divine lila. Sri Chaitanya enjoyed an extraordinary reputation as a debater and exponent of the Shastras. The scholars of medieval Navadvipa had perfected the science of disputation to a point which remains unrivaled by modern logicians, and they studied that science with vigor. Hosts of aged scholars and eminent logicians flocked to Navadvipa to gain knowledge and fame by propounding their own interpretations of the Shastra. But 14-year-old Nimai surpassed them all. The Lord strongly derided these self-styled teachers of philosophy and took great delight in dissecting their fallacious arguments. He would meticulously refute the varying opinions and then merrily re-establish them all again with sound logic. He would arrogantly chide the long hairs, saying, "I promise to recognize as a true scholar only he who dares to meet me in fair debate even once. I am not concerned for my position because factually there is no one in the three worlds who can stand against me, not even if I allow my opponent the handicap of using my own infallible propositions as his premise." Thus the Lord boasted, and his bragging words destroyed the pride of all who heard them. Superficially, the learned residents of Navadvipa acted as though they were unaffected by Nimai's sharp words, regarding him as a mere teacher of grammar. But not a single person accepted Nimai Pandit's challenge because they knew the truth of his words. There is no denying that during this period, Sri Gaurasundar exhibited the qualities of arrogance personified, but it is important to understand its underlying cause. The non-submissive attitude of young Nimai was not at all like material arrogance, in which the tiny jiva becomes puffed up due to some imagined excess in one of the six opulences. The Lord eternally possesses full knowledge of past, present, and future simultaneously. Therefore, there is no question of misconduct on his part. Actually, all the activities of the Lord, who is Atmarama, self-satisfied, are meant to benefit the living entities who have forgotten their real positions as his eternal servitors. Even when the Lord kills a demon, it is to be understood that he is bestowing his mercy upon that living entity, who immediately gets liberation. The Lord's arrogance and uncompromising attitude was intended to eradicate the perverse streak of impiety in the mundane scholars, who were grossly misleading innocent people and causing their spiritual ruination. Those who distinguish between arrogance used in the service of God and humility practiced for the same purpose commit a grave error, for such a distinction does not actually exist. Non-devotees feign humility to gain good reputation, but real humility, however, means that one is free from selfish ambition and sees himself as insignificant in comparison to his Lord. This is the attitude of a devotee. A devotee of the Lord has only his Lord's interests at heart, and therefore he may sometimes act and speak strongly on the Lord's behalf. Godhead is never served by external conduct. Good manners in themselves have no value. They have value only if used in the service of the Lord. Only true devotees of the Lord can understand how he may best be served by loyal arrogance and most basely betrayed by a self-seeking show of humility. These controversial qualities of the Lord were not only misunderstood by the atheistic speculators, but by the Lord's own devotees, the Vaishnavas, as well. The Lord is always completely independent, and although he is the absolute truth, he reserves the right of not manifesting himself to everyone. As mentioned earlier, not even Lakshmi Devi can see the Lord whenever he desires otherwise. Only by the Lord's special mercy can one perceive and understand him as he is. The entire time Lord Gaurasundar indulged in these learned pastimes, not a single person in all of Navadvip, neither the Vaishnavas nor the atheistic teachers, recognized his divine nature, although his intellectual performances were most extraordinary, even from the point of view of empiric scholarship. In this connection, one very remarkable incident has been recorded by Sri Vrindavan Das Thakur. One day, Keshava Kashmiri came to Navadvip. He was famed as a great scholar and controversialist and had assumed the proud title Digvijayi, the conqueror of all quarters. The epithet not only proclaimed his undisputed victory over every pundit he had ever met in controversy, but served as an open challenge as well. For along with the pompous title went the custom of receiving signed declarations of inferiority from all whom he defeated. Submit yourself, or meet with me in open debate, was the message. His heart would know no satisfaction till he beheld the greatest scholars of the world before him, with heads bowed and bended knees. It was for this purpose that the touted Digvijayi had come to Navadvip, the undisputed center of learning at that time. Keshava Kashmiri had received a benediction from the goddess of learning herself, that he would never be conquered. Thus, he was fully confident of his ability to defeat the pundits of Navadvip, despite their high reputation. When Keshava Kashmiri spoke, he found that all the shastras miraculously appeared on the tip of his tongue, without any effort on his part. And the questions which constantly suggested themselves to him were such that no antagonist was ever able to offer a satisfactory reply. In fact, his questions alone were usually sufficient to silence his opponent, and thus he usually never even bothered to engage in debate at all. When the fame of Navadvip reached his ears, he hastened there with his great retinue of richly decorated horses and elephants, defeating, almost out of habit, all the pundits along the way. As news of the conqueror's arrival spread, Nadia's intellectual community was seized with fear. The leading Bhattacharyas of Navadvip put aside their work and racked their brains over how they might avoid their impending defeat. They were unnerved by the prospect of contending with one whom Mother Saraswati herself had blessed. They knew very well that this Digvijayi from afar could easily defeat them in their own stronghold, and they heavily lamented the loss of prestige they were about to suffer. Those woeful tidings soon reached the ears of Gauranga. One day, a group of his students approached him, saying, "A certain conqueror of all quarters, having won the favor of Mother Saraswati, is touring the country, vanquishing all pundits. He has in his possession the signed certificates from the defeated parties proclaiming his superiority, and he has a large following of splendid horses, elephants, and servants. He has recently arrived in town and has actually settled in Navadvip. He wants to engage in debate with any rival who dares to speak up. If no antagonist is prepared to take up his challenge, he demands that every one of us must forthwith supply him with written confessions of our defeat." Upon hearing this, the Lord laughed and said, "Listen to me, brothers, for I am telling you the real truth. The Supreme Lord never tolerates conceit. Whatever intoxicates a person to indulge in vanity, the Lord always takes away. Humility is the constant companion of a person endowed with all good qualities. Have you not heard of the fate of all the mightiest conquerors of old, such as Haihai, Vaina, Bana, Naraka, Ravana? Was there ever any person whose egotism was not brought down? Godhead never tolerates conceit. For this reason, I assure you that this conqueror of all quarters will be completely humbled at this very place." Coming to the bank of the Ganges in the evening, the Lord sat down and thought of how he might conquer this so-called conqueror of all quarters. He did not like the idea of defeating him in open debate in the public assembly, as such a defeat would cause the death of that Brahmin who had become so puffed up by his victories, filling him with the notion that he had no equal in the whole world. Moreover, such defeat would also evoke jeers and violence from the populace, who would immediately fall upon him and plunder his belongings. However, if the Brahmin were vanquished in a private encounter, he would be cured of his vanity without suffering the terrible pain of public defeat. While the Lord was considering this, Keshava Kashmiri, the conqueror of all quarters himself, came to that very spot. What ensued thereafter has been graphically described by Vrindavan Das Thakur. The clear night sky was illuminated by the gorgeous moon of Bengal. The waters of the Bhagirathi, dressed in her most sacred aspect of indescribable glory, reflected those cooling rays, creating the perfect setting for the Supreme Lord, whose beauty captivates the hearts of every living entity. The charming face of the Lord was constantly lit up with a gracious smile, and his two lotus eyes bore the eternal look of divine benediction. His fine teeth, set between his ruddy lips, scorned the beauty of pearls. His whole frame was delicately soft and emanated kindness. His beautiful face was framed by a profusion of fine, black, wavy hair scattered across his forehead. His neck was poised like a lion's, and his shoulders were broad like an elephant's. His holy, golden form was perfectly dimensioned, and his beautiful chest was encircled by Sri Anantadev in the form of the sacred thread. His fine forehead was decorated with long, beautiful tilak. His exquisite hands reached down to his knees. He wore his cloth in the elegant Yogapati style, and he sat with his right foot placed upon the loop of the left thigh. Thus exhibiting his divinely radiant beauty, Sri Gaurachandra, the moon of Navadvip, engaged in expounding upon the Shastras, establishing the contrapositives of all conclusions. Keshava Kashmiri was very much surprised upon beholding this wonderful sight, and thought to himself, "Is this, perhaps, Nimai Pandit?" Stopping, he gazed, unnoticed, upon the beauty of the Lord for a long time, without once removing his eyes from that dazzling figure of picturesque beauty. He then inquired from one of Nimai's disciples, "What is his name?" and was told in reply, "He is, indeed, the great Nimai Pandit himself." Thereupon, after making his obeisances to the Ganges, the conqueror made his way into the midst of the assembly of the Lord. A slight smile played upon the lips of the Lord as he welcomed Kashyapa cordially, inviting him to take a seat. The conqueror of all quarters was fearless in disposition, but nevertheless, he experienced a feeling of great awe at the sight of the Lord. The Lord received him with adoration, but because Kashyapa Kashmiri was very proud, he talked to the Lord very inconsiderately, saying, "I understand that you are a teacher of Vyakarana, and that your name is Nimai Pandit. People speak highly of your teaching of beginner's grammar." The Lord replied, "Yes, I am known as a teacher of grammar, but factually I cannot impress my students with grammatical knowledge, nor can they understand me very well." Since Kashyapa Kashmiri was a little puffed up, the Lord increased his artificial pride by presenting himself as subordinate to him. Thus, he flattered the Digvijaya as follows: "My dear sir, whereas you are a very learned scholar in all sorts of scriptures and are very experienced in composing poetry, I am only a boy, a new student, and nothing more." The Lord further remarked that they would all be delivered from their sins if he would favor them with a poetic account of the glories of the holy Ganges. Hearing these words, Kashyapa Kashmiri became even more puffed up, and immediately began to praise the Ganges in verses which he composed on the spot. These verses were so lilting and contained such varied figures that his recitation appeared to possess the amplitude and dignity of the voice from the clouds. Saraswati herself was present on his tongue, and therefore whatever he said was perfect in every way. No human being possessed the power to compose the like, or even comprehend the full depth of meaning of his spontaneous composition. All the students of the Lord, who numbered in the thousands, were astonished to hear such a description. "Ram, Ram," they shouted, "it is most wonderful. How can such words come from any mortal?" The Digvijaya's description was virtuously laden with all conceivable rhetorical embellishments. Even those who were deeply versed in all branches of the Shastra found it extremely difficult to follow him. In this fashion, the conqueror spoke on for one quarter of the night, and still he did not finish. When the conqueror ceased at last, Sri Gaurasundara laughed sarcastically, saying, "Your poetry is so difficult that no one can understand it but you and Mother Saraswati. But if you can explain the meaning of even one verse, we can all hear it from your own mouth and thus be very happy." The Digvijaya, Kashyapa Kashmiri, inquired which verse the Lord wanted him to explain. The Lord then recited one of the 100 verses Kashyapa Kashmiri had composed. "The greatness of Mother Ganges always brilliantly exists. She is the most fortunate because she emanated from the lotus feet of Sri Vishnu, the personality of Godhead. She is the second goddess of fortune, and therefore she is always worshipped both by the demigods and by humanity. Endowed with all wonderful qualities, she flourishes on the head of Lord Shiva." When Lord Chaitanya asked him to explain the meaning of this verse, the champion, very much astonished, inquired from him as follows: "I recited all the verses like the blowing wind. How could you completely learn by heart even one among those verses?" The Lord replied, "By the grace of the Lord, someone may become a great poet, and similarly, by his grace, someone may become a great Shrutidhar who can memorize anything immediately." Satisfied by this statement of Lord Chaitanya, Kashyapa Kashmiri explained the quoted verse. Then the Lord said, "Now kindly explain the special qualities and faults in the verse." The Brahmin replied, "There is not a tinge of fault in that verse. Rather, it has the good qualities of simile and alliteration." The Lord said, "My dear sir, I may say something to you if you will not become angry. Can you explain the faults in this verse? There is no doubt that your poetry is full of ingenuity, and certainly it has satisfied the Supreme Lord. Yet, if we scrutinizingly consider it, we can find both good qualities and faults. Now, therefore, let us carefully scrutinize this verse." The poet replied, "Yes, the verse you have recited is perfectly correct. You are an ordinary student of grammar, What do you know about literary embellishments? You cannot review this poetry because you do not know anything about it. Keshava Kashmiri tried to bluff Lord Chaitanya by saying that since he was not an advanced student in literary style, he could not review a verse that was full of metaphors and literary ornaments. Taking a humble position, Lord Chaitanya said, because I am not of your level, I have asked you to teach me by explaining the qualities and faults in your poetry. Certainly, I have not studied the art of literary embellishments, but I have heard about it from higher circles, and thus I can review this verse and find in it many faults and many good qualities. The poet said, all right, let me see what qualities and faults you have found. The Lord replied, let me speak, and please hear me without becoming angry. My dear sir, in this verse there are 5 faults and 5 literary ornaments. I shall state them one after another. Kindly hear me, and then give your judgment. After elaborating on the 5 gross faults and 5 literary embellishments of the verse, Lord Chaitanya concluded, actually, if we examine it in fine detail, we will find unlimited faults. But please do not mind. After hearing the explanation of Lord Chaitanya, the champion poet, struck with wonder, his cleverness stunned, could not say anything. He wanted to say something, but no reply could come from his mouth. He then began to consider this puzzle within his mind. This mere boy has blocked my intelligence. I can therefore understand that Mother Saraswati has become angry with me. This wonderful explanation could not have been possible for a human being. Therefore, Mother Saraswati herself must have personally spoken through his mouth. Then the Lord asked him not to mind, but give them something fresh. But the conqueror found that he no longer possessed his former power of composition. As the conqueror of all quarters sat in the agony of his defeat, the pupils of the Lord made a gesture of laughter at his expense. But the Lord forbade all misbehavior and spoke kindly to the Brahmin. He said that the conqueror had made an exhausting effort by composing those wonderful verses, and was naturally very much fatigued by his exertions. The night is far advanced, the Lord said. The controversy should be postponed till tomorrow. Let us part this night with mutual goodwill, and you shall return to your lodging and take rest without feeling discouraged. The Lord was always tender with his opponents. Those whom he vanquished in controversy did not experience any sorrow. The Lord behaved in the same way toward all the professors of Navadvip. Although he defeated them all, the Lord never broke the spirit of those he vanquished. Thus everyone was pleased with him. It was for this reason that every one of those pundits who lived in Navadvip was, in his heart of hearts, well disposed to Nimai Pandit. The Lord made his way home in the company of his disciples. The conqueror of all quarters felt extremely ashamed at heart. In his distress, the Brahmin thought, Saraswati herself gave me this blessing. I have met in debate all those who are well versed in Nyaya, Sankhya, Patanjala, Mimamsa, Vaisheshika, and Vedanta philosophies. I have found no one in the whole world who could even advance a plausible view in opposition to my own. There is no question of their having any ability to defeat me. But such is a contrivance of providence that this Brahmin boy, who is barely a teacher of Vyakarana, a subject for infants, should be actually able to defeat me. The boon of Saraswati herself would seem to be unsure. There is good cause for the greatest anxiety in this. I must have committed some offense against the goddess, and because of this, the power of my genius has been lessened. I must find out the cause of it this very day. Thinking in this way, the Brahmin sat down to chant his mantra and afterwards took rest with a sad heart. In his dreams, Mother Saraswati appeared before him. Casting her merciful glance upon that fortunate Brahmin, she began to tell him the most carefully hidden secrets in the scriptures. Mother Saraswati said, listen, good Brahmin, for I am going to reveal unto you the hidden secrets of the Vedas. If you disclose this to anyone, your life will surely be cut short. You should know that he at whose hands you have suffered defeat is most assuredly the Lord of all the endless universes. He is, indeed, the selfsame Lord whose lotus feet I forever serve. I feel ashamed even to appear before him, because my function is to delude all creatures into the vanities of false ego. And therefore, it has no admission into the sphere that is lit up by the glance of Vasudeva. It is I who speak through your mouth, but I have no power in his divine presence. Not to speak of my insignificant feelings of helplessness, even the divine Anantashesh himself, who expands the Vedas by his thousands of mouths, and is the worshipped as Aja, Bhava, and the great God, is bewildered in the presence of the Supreme Lord, whom you have seen face to face in the form of a Brahmin boy. He is transcendentally great, eternally pure, indivisible, and irreducible, and is fully present within the hearts of all living entities. From him proceeds work, knowledge, learning, all good and evil, the visible and the invisible, and in fact, everything which is not possible for me to fully recount to you. All the creatures from Brahma on down that are subject to suffering undergo tribulation by his command. All the avatars, such as the fish, tortoise, etc., of whom you have heard, are none other than he. He is the same Lord who saves the world in his form of a boar, and the same Lord who protects Prahlad in his form of Nrisinga. He is the life of Bali in his form of Vamana, whose lotus feet are the source of the holy Ganges. It is he who appeared in Ayodhya and killed the wicked Ravana by his wonderful, endless pastimes. And it is he who is called the son of Vasudeva Nanda. Currently, he is present on this earth as the son of a Brahmin, actively engaged in the pleasures of learning. Not even the Veda personified is aware of the Lord's appearance in this form. One can know him only if he makes himself known. Who has the power to know him otherwise? Up until now, the many mantras that you have chanted unto me have not yet yielded their full fruits. Up till now, you have merely attained the status of conqueror of all quarters. Now, you have at last attained the real fruit of my mantras, inasmuch as you have had direct sight of the Lord of all existence. O Vipra, go quickly to his lotus feet and surrender your body, mind, and words unto him. Don't consider this visitation an idle dream. I have divulged to you the hidden knowledge of the Vedas under the influence of my mantra. Saying this, the goddess Saraswati disappeared and the Brahmin woke up. At early dawn, the Brahmin immediately made his way to the presence of the Lord. The Vipra paid his prostrated obeisances at the lotus feet of the Lord, who thereupon lifted him up into his arms, asking, "Brother, what is the meaning of this behavior?" The Vipra replied, "Such is the merciful glance of thine eyes." The Lord asked again, "Being the undisputed conqueror of all quarters, why do you behave this way with me?" Keshava Kashmiri said, "Please listen, O Prince of Brahmins. All work is fulfilled by serving you. You are Narayan in the form of one of the twice-born in the Kali Yuga. Who has the power to recognize you? This suspicion grew in my mind as my power of speech deserted me, and now it is confirmed. You are declared the breaker of all worldly vanity by all the scriptures. I have truly experienced this undoubtable truth. You overcame me 3 times and yet preserved my reputation. Could such a thing be possible except by the power of the Supreme Lord himself? Therefore, it is most certain that you are Narayan himself. In all the learned societies in the world, such as Gaur, Delhi, and Kashi, Gujarat, Vijayanagar, Kanchipuri, Anga, Banga, Tailanga, Odra, and other places, there is no scholar who could even understand my words, far less find fault with them. I, who am so clever, failed to establish anything in your presence. How did I lose my good intelligence? Actually, this feat of yours is not at all wonderful, for the goddess of learning herself has told me that you are her lord. Most auspicious indeed was the planetary conjunction upon which I set foot in Navadvip. I, so deeply sunk in the world of Maya, have obtained the sight of you. I, who have remained entangled in ignorant, selfish desires and have long wandered astray, utterly deceiving myself, by good fortune I have now obtained the sight of you. Please deliver me by your merciful glance. It is your nature to do good to all. There is no one except you who is the refuge of all, and who is truly merciful to all. Be pleased, O Great One, so as to instruct me in such a way that there may never again arise any sinful desire in my mind. Thus, a very humble conqueror of all quarters praised the Lord in many ways with sincere penitence. Hearing these fervent words of the Brahmin, Sri Gaurasundar smiled and he replied, "Listen, illustrious Brahmin, on whose tongue Saraswati herself abides. You are indeed most fortunate. The use of learning does not lie in conquering all quarters. That scholarship alone is genuine that serves the Supreme Lord. Consider this well and with attention. When a person leaves his body, his wealth or any other human qualification never accompanies him. It is for this reason that all those who are pure of heart apply themselves with firm purpose to serve the Supreme Lord, completely disregarding all other occupations. Therefore, O Vipra, giving up all sinful ways, make haste to worship the feet of Sri Krishna without delay, and continue to serve Krishna with firm conviction until you are overtaken by death. Know for certain that the only due fruit of learning is obtained when one's mind and work continue to abide at the lotus feet of Sri Krishna. I declare unto you the highest truth. Devotion to Vishnu is the one thing that is true in all these countless worlds." Having said this, the Lord of Vaikuntha, being pleased with the Brahmin, embraced him, and Keshava Kashmiri was thus released from all his worldly attachments. The Lord said, "O Brahmin, give up all vanity and be merciful to all beings. Whatever Saraswati might have told you, never divulge to anyone else. By revealing the hidden truth of the scriptures at this time, one's span of life is cut short, and such a person badly suffers the consequences of such conduct in the next world." Upon receiving the command of the Lord, the great Brahmin paid many prostrated obeisances to him, repeatedly doing homage to his lotus feet. Finally, he departed. By the command of the Lord, devotion and detachment and true knowledge manifested themselves simultaneously in the heart of that Brahmin. The vanity of being Digvijaya completely disappeared, and the great conqueror became humbler than a blade of grass. After giving away every material possession he had, his elephants, horses, conveyances, wealth, and all other equipment, the conqueror of all quarters set out on his journey alone. A person who has obtained the Lord's mercy naturally takes to the occupation of begging, giving up all worldly opulence. In this age of Kali, Sri Davyakash brought testimony to this truth by preferring to live as a mendicant in the forest over his former princely position. Wealth and power, coveted by all the world, are discarded by a devotee after being favored by Krishna. A king's estate and other temporary positions are deemed pleasant only just so long as one is ignorant of the bliss of devotional service. Even liberation from the threefold miseries is considered trivial and insignificant by the devotees of Krishna, not to speak of the happiness coming from possession of kingdoms and other temporary things of this world. Nothing except the merciful glance of the Supreme Lord actually has any value, for which reason all the scriptures proclaim the superiority of devotional service to the Lord over all other activities. News of the Lord's victory over the conqueror quickly spread to all parts of Nadia. All the people were overwhelmed with astonishment and finally realized that Nimai Pandit was undoubtedly a very great scholar. They had never heard of a scholar who could defeat the Digvijaya. They confessed that Nimai Pandit had every justification for his pride, and it was only now that the real greatness of his learning was made apparent to all. Some said, if he had only read Nyaya, he could have easily attained the position of Bhattacharya. Some proposed that all the people should join together and confer upon him the title of Vadasimha, or Lion of Controversy. These proposals, says Vrindavan Das Thakur, showed the triumph of the Lord's deluding power, which prevented the people from recognizing his divine nature, even after they had heard of this incredible pastime. Thus, all over Nadia, everyone discussed the wonderful achievement of the Lord. The citizens of Navadvip deserve our homage, inasmuch as they were privileged to witness these pastimes of the Lord. Those who listen to this narration of the victory of the Lord over the conqueror of all quarters, says Vrindavan Das Thakur, never have any further occasion of suffering defeat in their own case. Grace can be obtained only through the agency of his pure devotee, the spiritual master. Conditioned souls can never realize the absolute truth by means of their limited mental and intellectual faculties. Therefore, unless they accept the Lord's causeless mercy in the form of divine revelation coming from the spiritual master and the chanting of the holy name, they are doomed to lives of continued ignorance and suffering. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu caused a flood of love of God to inundate the land. Just one drop of that ocean of nectar makes the bliss of Brahman realization appear dry and useless, devoid of any sweetness and variety. What then is there to say of the fleeting, flickering, temporal, and illusory pleasures of this world, which culminate in complete misery and confusion? The Lord has kindly given those of us in this human form of life the intelligence to understand God and our eternal relationship with Him. If we misuse this precious gift in pursuit of inferior pleasures, we simply become increasingly frustrated and consequently fall back down into a species of life wherein such animalistic pleasures can be enjoyed without regulation. Only when we seek happiness in connection with the Lord, who is the source and reservoir of all pleasure, will our soul's desire for perfect eternal love and harmony be satisfied. The truth of this is automatically revealed in the heart of one who sincerely strives to attain the lotus feet of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Lord Chaitanya and Lord Nityananda are compared to the sun and moon who rise simultaneously on the horizon of Gaur, the spiritual world, to dissipate the darkness of ignorance and bestow their benediction upon everyone without question of qualification. The mission to bring the sun of Lord Chaitanya westward was begun by Bhaktivinoda Thakur. It was ordered by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, carried out by Srila Prabhupada, and is now being continued and expanded by his disciples and grand disciples. In this way, that same mercy that Lord Chaitanya was distributing 500 years ago is available today through the unbroken chain of discipular succession of the Madhva Gaudiya Sampradaya, coming down from Lord Chaitanya and ultimately from Krishna himself. What the Upanishads describe as the impersonal Brahman is but the Lord's bodily effulgence, and the Lord sought after by the yogis as the supersoul is but his localized plenary portion. Sri Chaitanya is the source of that Brahman effulgence and of the supersoul as well. He is Swayam Bhagavan, Krishna himself, the original Supreme Personality of Godhead, from whom all the other incarnations emanate. He is the absolute truth, and no other truth is greater than or equal to him. There is no greater personality. He is perfectly full of all fame, all wealth, all strength, all beauty, all knowledge, and all renunciation. By his unlimited causeless mercy, he has appeared to the view of the people of this world just to bestow pure loving devotion to Sri Sri Radha and Krishna. Such a gift has never before been given. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is simultaneously the Lord, the Lord's devotee, and the spiritual master of all the worlds. Simply by remembering him, along with his devotees and the spiritual master, all difficulties on the path of self-realization are destroyed. One then quickly and easily obtains that most wonderful benediction, pure ecstatic love of God, life's ultimate goal. Hare Krishna.